Welcome. Give us another minute. All right. So today is it's the beginning of a new module, but it's also the last of like an odd timing of our class for a while. So when we meet next, we'll be back at our regular time for a while. We won't be meeting next week. Next week, I'm going to be leading a retreat for most of the week. So it'll be a great week for integration, especially because we've had a lot of bigger calls over the last couple of weeks. Today, we're going to start our Rewiring Your Negative Thought Patterns module. I'm really excited for it. Before we dive in, two pieces. So first, who over the last week has been able to kind of lovingly catch yourself in the moment when you've stepped into a resistance archetype or energetic vortex and be like, oh, wait, that's what's happening right now? Has that happened for anyone? I'd love to hear a share or two on that and what your experience has been as you've hopefully maybe been a little bit more aware of the resistance archetypes and kind of moving into that archetypal energy when you go into your defenses or kind of a deep fear. Who'd like to share? What have you been noticing, or when have you kind of called what happened as you've kind of like lovingly called yourself on it or not? Maybe you realized after the fact, which is great too. Anyone want to share?
I can share.
Awesome. Thanks, Kim. Go ahead.
The judge is a big one for me and comes up for when I am doing anything new. And I wrote that letter, and the judge was really wanting to be acknowledged and heard and seen. And what happens to me when the judge comes in is I feel like I disconnect from my heart. And so the judge was wanting this heart connection, but hadn't really felt that.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so beautiful. Why is that important for you? What's significant about the judge wanting this heart connection? When, how do you see it as valuable or helpful?
Well, it helps me have more compassion for the judge, and but I it's not like I've figured it out though.
It
Like, I still get out of my heart, and then I get on myself for not being in my heart.
Yes, that's the second piece I wanted to talk about before we dive into the stuff for today. So hold on that for a moment and we're gonna get there. I love that this came through with the letter and that the judge is asking for a heart connection and that you're feeling some of that compassion. And you know what that says, this is important for you and for us to know as we do this work with our clients. What that says to me is you're starting to create a different kind of relationship with the judge. You're relating, not only are you relating to the judge in a different way, that judge is starting to relate to you in a different way. And when you are in more aligned relationship, and a relationship isn't just one letter, right? We're not like BFF with someone after one encounter or discussion, but you've started to create a relationship now. When we come more and more into aligned relationship with any entity, that's when we can work together and support one another. Right.
That feels inspiring to hear that.
Yeah. Good. I'm so, so glad. And then what I want to slip to you and like for everybody to think about, the resistance archetypes are forms of shadow parts of ourselves. And we're not going to get into all of what that means. We look at that in advanced depth, but the piece that I want to pull out is that at the core of every shadow is a superpower. At the core of every shadow is a superpower. And I bring that up because, for example, for you, Kim, when you're in good relationship with your judge, that's a resource for you. Now, this may not be your judge's superpower, but for many people, their judge's superpower is the power of discernment, right? So when you're not in your defenses or you're not in your fear and like doing that judge thing, the judge actually helps you discern what's aligned and what's not aligned, what's a good idea and not a good idea, right? Because that is part of judgment when it's in its highest form. So we don't want to eradicate our resistance archetype, just like we don't want to eradicate fear. We want to start to work with it better. What are you hearing in that that's important for you?
I definitely had a conversation with the judge about discernment and how that's important. But what jumped out to me was the superpower of mine of empathy and the feeling. And you know how you say you get chills? What happens to me is I start crying. I cry in every coaching session. And it's like, oh, geez. But I just feel deeply. And yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. Wendy.
I would actually like to hear a little bit more about the superpower in the shadow. God, Kim, I don't even know if I can get through this without crying. So right there with you. My victim and judge are like so intertwined. The catastrophic negativity and the blaming and the helplessness, but then the judging of others while also just incredibly judging myself. I just wrote a letter to my father that I'm never gonna send, to try to give myself some space to say some shit that needs to be said. And so I guess when I hear you say at the core of every shadow is a superpower. So like I could hear when I read back my letter to myself, I could hear the victim. I could hear the judge. I could hear a lot of that. But I also heard, you know, a child that wasn't seen or valued or held or all the things. So is the superpower then like empathy and compassion and gentleness and kindness? Like, is that what that would be?
It absolutely could be. So first, I just want to honor you for being in this incredible process and doing this work that is not easy.
No.
And it says so much about you, Wendy, that you're willing and that you're committed you know, and so present to it. And so I just really want to honor you and also let you know that it's not always going to feel like this too. The more you do the work, I feel like I can pinky promise on that. And okay, so I want to answer in a short way. Also, sometimes it takes like 3 days in retreat for me to get to the, like, to the, when we really look deeply at the shadow piece, but I'm going to say two things that I think will be helpful. Yeah, what I'm hearing is yes, like because of your experiences and the ways that you have been conscious through them and the ways that you have been working with them and because of who you are, like, yes, empathy as an example is such a superpower that has, it might be at the core of the resistance archetype, but it might be a result because of all of the experiences as a, like something that you've developed as a way to support yourself from it. I don't know, you know, we'd have to like look a lot deeper. So that's one thing. So empathy, yes, is a superpower. I'm not sure, we'd have to look more if that's at the core of the superpower. Usually the superpower that's at the core of the shadow is the higher level behavior of that shadow. So, and it can be different for everyone because this is so personal for us. But so for example, when I say for many people, discernment is the superpower of the judge, is because when the judge is in an aligned place, when the judge isn't just reacting and in its defenses, one of the skills of the judge is to see right from wrong. For me, one of the higher, the superpowers of my a victim part is like, I'm amazingly dramatic, which helps me move rooms when I need to, move rooms from grief to joy, to anger, to right, or like create drama that draws people in. When I'm in reaction and defenses, that drama is like helplessness and woe is me, you know, right? But that's just for me. For someone else, they might have a different superpower that is embedded in their victim archetype. Is that helpful to think of it that way?
That demonstration was actually incredibly helpful, more than I can even explain. So just thank you for that. And just thanks for being with me in all this.
Thank you for sharing. Okay, good. So I want to encourage you each to continue as you move through your weeks to notice when the archetypes come up, when you step into the energy. I want to encourage you to continue to write the letters or take some moments to have compassion with the archetype, to dialogue with it, or to dialogue with the fear that's underneath it. And all of that brings me to the second piece that I wanted to just underscore as we go into our work for today. I'm going to keep on coming back to this. This relates to Kim saying, well, it's still there, which is to remind you again, and I keep on reminding you and keep on reminding you the difference between a breakthrough and a transformation. The breakthrough is like that first letter and that, the judge wants my attention, right? Whatever it is. And all that comes with it. The breakthrough is the spark of a new relationship with the fear, with the resistance archetype. The breakthrough is a new thought, a new idea, a new vision, a new way of being, a new understanding of connecting the dots. We absolutely want those. That being said, that's almost the like easier, sexy work. the real work, it's all real work, but the less sexy work that is actually holds the most potency is what comes after the breakthrough, which is continuing to come back to the relationship, continuing to come back to deepening the relationship, continuing to track, continuing to hold space for the fear or the resistance with compassion and with love, finding that regulated place even as the fear or the resistance comes up, and continuing to come back to it, and continuing to come back to it, and continuing to come back to it until it tips over into real change in your life and in your client's life. This is the harder work because it's not as sexy, because it takes persistence, right? When we create a breakthrough, co-create a breakthrough in a session with a client, it often can create enough of an opening and a loosening of things and an inspiration and a motivation for the client to take the next baby step or the next two or three outer action baby steps towards their goals, which is great. And then the taking of those action steps will actually help support the unwinding of the fear, the unwinding of the resistance. Like it all supports, but we don't want to lose the thread of giving homework to our clients to also come back to the inner work, of coming back to it in session. You know, a common thing is like, oh, I already did that, right? Like been there, done that. I don't need to do it again. But actually the doing it again and the doing it again and the doing it again is what helps us integrate and embody and move towards the transformation. So I know for myself in my own work, inner work, I have to create containers for myself to come back to my journaling, to come back to my somatic work, to come back to my belief work. And when I go long periods of not, because I am a human being and I lapse or things get busy or whatever, like that's when I'm more reactive in my life. Just plain and simple. Every now and again, I just like have a good stretch where I don't have to do the inner work and I'm not reacting, right? But I mean, it's like, this is it. Not sexy, but maybe very sexy if you think about it in terms of the long game. And so I share this with all of you so that you understand as practitioners, and also to say in sacred depths, if I like had my ideal sacred depths, this would be a 2-year program where we would like do resistance archetypes. And then the next 2 months, we would just do persistent work on the resistance archetypes and persistent work and persistent. But I don't know that anyone would sign up for that. So I put the responsibility in your hands. This isn't to overwhelm you with do persistent, you know, work on befriend your fear, do persistent work on resistance archetypes, do persistent work on negative thought patterns all at the same time, but pick one thing that feels poignant to you and give yourself the gift, truly the gift of committing to persistent work on it. Anything that wants to be said about this piece? It's a really important piece. The sparking, anything for anyone or anything that wants to be said? Lisa.
I loved how you languaged what you just said, and is what I've been noticing with new clients, sometimes in the sales call or even after their first session, they haven't yet. I offer standalone sessions or whatever. I'm trying to get people to commit to regular work for this very reason. Do you use that language with them? This potency, the most potency is to continue to come back to relationship with it in the breakthrough versus transformation language, or is that like back stage language?
No, I mean, I recommend using it like if in a sales process, right? Because it's the truth, right? If that's what a particular prospect, if that's what's going to be important for them to hear, because really like the one session isn't going to be enough. And it is about the continuing and the consistency. Absolutely. You want to speak to them about that in the sales conversation. And it's interesting that you're bringing this up, Lisa, because I think this is related to something you brought up a couple weeks. I don't think I'm making this up. I think this is related to something you brought up a couple weeks ago, and this shifting from like the work on the table to the work. I was just this week working with one of my private clients who she's been through Sacred Depths. She's a coach, but primarily, or when she started, she is a medium. And she really, she's incredible. Like you should get in a room with someone and she channel the messages from the ancestors. And we were talking about how a session of mediumship, like channeling a message from the ancestors, is valuable, but not valuable. Because people get all of this information and then they don't know what to do with it. It's like, now what? There's fear, there's resistance to move forward with what the ancestors are telling them to do. They don't know how to, and that's where the persistence and the consistency of the coaching and the coming back to the, that's really what makes that one mediumship session so valuable for the client.
Yeah, and I love that you brought that up, because that same thing applies to tarot readings or intuitive readings, like or somebody telling you, you had a past life as a blah, blah. Yeah. I call it the TV watching of spiritual growth, because it's, you don't have somebody reflect something, you have to embody and live it to really integrate the information in any useful way.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
And one more quick question. Would you put any of this on your website?
I have it on my website. Yes. I mean, absolutely. One of my rules of marketing is if it feels like important, potent information, say it or write it or have it where people are going to see it.
Yeah. Because I get a lot of people who go, they come for their session and they go, I was told, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, you were told. Yeah. We don't really tell people. Yeah. We're going to bring it from inside sort of stuff. So
yes, absolutely. Good. I'm going to take one more share or thought or question from Kelly, and then we're going to continue on.
Yeah, in terms of things that I'm reflecting on, one, I just had this flash of the story of the miracle worker. And I played this, it's the story of Helen Keller. And I remembered playing this in high school. I played Helen. And there's this moment at the very end of the show where she suddenly understands that water is the thing that's been spelled into her hand in the sign language. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was the total breakthrough. And then, but that said nothing of all the work they had, decades of work to like learn the meanings of all the things and to create this amazing human who like left us with so many gifts. So that was one thing that just popped in as you were speaking. And I was like, oh, that was such a good visual of the like the breakthrough versus the long-term dedication to transformation. And the other thing is that I had written to you about this, but I have this speaking engagement coming up in September. And the speaking engagement, I was talking with the leadership team this past week, but it's also happened in almost every client session where it's come up where people are like, why can't I do this thing? And I'm just finding that people are really wanting to dive into understanding more. And as soon as I say the word resistance and just speak to normalizing it, people are like, oh, yes. And they are just hungry for diving in. And that's been really amazing to just name it. Like, it's so simple and we all have it and we can work with it. And people just being like, yes, please, please, please. And so I'm just so aware of that right now in terms of what I'm
doing. Yeah, I'm so glad you're bringing that back in. And I think just like the way you described it, it's so easy, it's clear to see part of that yes, yes, yes is because you're normalizing it, right? Yeah. And the normalizing immediately starts to take some of the shame out of it. And then it's like, okay, now we can look at this. We can come face to face with this because this isn't a terrible thing about me.
Yeah.
It's just a thing about being a human being.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Good. Okay, great. All right. So with all of that, let's dive in to rewiring negative thought patterns. We'll be training today, and then in 2 weeks, we'll finish up our training call, and then you'll get a recording of a demo on it. So when you're experiencing negative thought patterns, and you know, we can say like that's that very persistent voice inside of your head that wants to tell you that what you're doing isn't enough, or that you're not enough, or that you can't, or that you're not doing it the right way, you know, whatever it is. And when you tell those types of messages to yourself, I can't, it's never going to be good enough, this, you know, whatever it is, when you tell those types of messages to yourself, you're more prone to give up or to overwork or to make a decision that isn't aligned for you about whatever the situation is. Or you're more prone to be in kind of a constant state of anxiety. In other words, even though your thoughts are in your head, they have a huge effect on your actions. Your everyday thoughts have a massive effect on your success, your well-being, how you feel throughout the day, and on your actions. I'm sure most of you have heard the saying, thoughts become things. And that's exactly why, as a practitioner, it's so important to understand how thoughts work. And that's why we're giving this focused attention in the training. As we go into this, the other thing that I want to point out is that often our negative thoughts can be or sound very similar to our fears. And that's okay. I'm just giving like different tools. I want you to have lots of different tools in your toolbox to work with clients as things come up. So I'm not good enough can be a fear. It can also be a thought, right? And you have your choice of different kind of tools to use with it. All right. So let's define first what I mean when I say negative thoughts or negative thinking patterns. There are a lot of different ways that we can define this, but for the sake of our training, we're going to explore negative thoughts as follows. Thoughts or internal recordings that persistently or semi-persistently run through your mind and hurt you in some way. I'm going to say that again. Negative thoughts or thinking patterns, for our purposes, are thoughts or recordings that persistently or semi-persistently run through your mind and hurt you in some way. Now, negative self-talk isn't necessarily, I'm going to put quotes around this, good or bad. We don't want to look at it as, oh, it's good to have these thoughts and it's bad to have those thoughts. What instead, the way I want us to look at this is, are these thoughts helpful or not helpful? Are these thoughts helpful or not helpful? If they're unhelpful, if they stop you from taking aligned action, if they cause anxiousness, if they initiate self-sabotage, then we want to work through them and shift them. Another way that we can think about negative thought patterns, because this is how they can often show up, not always, but often, is as catastrophic thinking. Catastrophic thinking. It's like we think the worst. I'll never be able to do this. We'll talk more about catastrophic thinking later in class, but for right now, just ask yourself, are you prone to catastrophic thinking? Do you, in your mind, often jump to the worst case possible scenario and then get stuck there? And by the way, no judgment whatsoever if you do. I am a catastrophic thinker. I was actually trained by my parents and their parents by them to be a very catastrophic thinker. And I will, as for inspiration, I will tell you, we can also work our ways out of it. I find that catastrophic thinking, not always, but often, it can run in families or run in cultures. Okay, so here's the tricky thing about negative thought patterns. As human beings who think, and particularly very smart human beings, like everyone is here, and particularly in a culture where we've really placed so much focus on our minds and mental thought, we tend to think very, very quickly, right? So especially in our culture, and especially if we're smart, we think quickly. Why is this important? Because negative thoughts like, I can't, I'll never be able to, she doesn't like me, I'm this, I'm that, whatever it is, they snap, they fire off very quickly. Sometimes so quickly that they're not even in complete sentences in our mind. Sometimes so quickly that it can create harm before our higher wisdom can even detect that a thought has fired off. In other words, it's oftentimes, it takes some work and some practice to even notice or be conscious of our negative thought patterns. And then what happens is, we think the negative thought, we haven't caught it, and then we think it over and over again without catching it. And then eventually we just begin to accept it as truth. And we don't even think to call it out. So we're taking a lot of our negative thoughts as truth that we're not even questioning sometimes or interrogating sometimes. But the truth is that a lot of negative self-talk is inaccurate. The thoughts are simply not true. So, for example, let's say that you send out a resume for a job and you didn't get called for the interview. Your very quick fire negative thought patterning or negative self-talk might go like this. Oh, great. See, I knew it. I'm not going to get this job and I'm never going to get any job that really excites me. I may as well just quit now and accept that I'm stuck in my current meaningless career. And really, it's like a meaningless existence. Nothing is ever going to change. Okay, so that is also a little bit of catastrophic thinking that I was talking about earlier. But what I want to point out here is the importance of distinguishing between what's true and then what's story or inaccurate. What's true here is that you sent out a resume and didn't get called for the job. That is true. Everything else is false. It's just a story. But when we're thinking so quick, it all jumbles together, right? And we just accept it as truth. Okay. I'll go a little further and then we'll pause for thoughts and looking a little deeper. Another way that negative thoughts function is that we stew in them. We get stuck repeating them over and over. And then it's almost like they can keep us in a holding pattern where we just keep on thinking the negative thought instead of brainstorming solutions on how to move through a problem, or how to move through the problem that triggered the negative thoughts in the first place. So we can stew in them. They can also often support us in staying angry or frustrated, either at ourselves or others, so that we don't actually move on to solving a problem or taking action. Sometimes it's just way easier, and this can be a resistance archetype, right? To stay angry or blame yourself or someone else than to actually strategize and move out of the problem that you're having. So a really useful book that is related to all of this, it's quite a few years old now, but I think it's still a goodie, is The New Earth. Some of you might know this, by Eckhart Tolle. One thing that Tolle talks about in The New Earth is the pain body. And the way that he describes the pain body is he describes it like this, that literally the pain body are your thoughts that are addicted to pain or to being in pain. So the pain body are our thoughts, or when our ego are addicted to being in pain. The pain body will do whatever it takes to remain in the energy of pain. So I want to let that land for a moment. When I read this, and of course this can also be related to trauma, but when I read this over a decade ago, I nearly lost my breath. It just resonated so deeply for me. And I recognize this in some of my clients. Your pain body will do whatever it takes to remain in the energy of pain. In other words, oftentimes we can tend to gravitate more towards pain than towards pleasure or joy or contentment. And a lot of times the way we gravitate towards pain is through our negative thoughts. So I want you to take a moment, check this out for yourself. Have you ever gotten stuck in your pain body where it's like you're just stewing in it. You're just stewing in the thoughts and stewing in the thoughts and stewing in the thoughts. And then maybe a friend or a family member or a partner says, oh, you know, maybe it's not so bad. You can look at the situation this way. Or maybe you can do this. Or maybe a coach or a mentor, you know, offers a different way of looking at something, but literally you're so almost addicted to being in the negative thoughts, or it could be the judge as well, or to staying in that pain, that you even get angry at others for even thinking that it could be seen another way. Does that ever happen for you? Now, just as an aside, practitioner point of view, this is why we always want to honor what is first before working on anything around this with a client, because if we don't feel seen or heard, then it can just look like someone's trying to throw solutions our way. All right, let me pause here because we've looked at a lot of pieces so far. What is really resonating for you so far? What's feeling important, Angie?
I'm just having a lot of aha moments connecting this. You already brought up the pain body piece with Eckhart Tolle, and I'll just say that a couple of other texts that I'm pretty deep into right now, working through some of these things for myself so that I can be able to work through them with clients, are one is The Untethered Soul, and the other is The Big Red Book for Adult Children of Alcoholics and Dysfunctional Families, and how what you're talking about with the pain body is very similar to in The Untethered Soul. The way he describes this is that we all have these negative thought patterns that our bodies have imprinted from experiences when we were little or whatever, and they're called samskaras. And so whenever we get caught in a loop, it doesn't, what you're saying, it doesn't even occur to us to recognize that it's a feeling. It's just that our body goes back and relives it somatically the same way it always has, even if it's a trauma from 10, 15, 20 years ago. And we can't get ourselves out of that. And so, of course, consciousness and being aware of our soul and our minds is the way to kind of work through it. And the terminology in ACA is for like the adult child, because we have the inner child that stays with us and it grows up into this adult body. And we don't think about all of these ways that we have been traumatized or victimized. And it's all about thought interruption, but it's just funny. It's all very in my awareness right now. And so I just love that there are so many different approaches and ways of thinking about it, that these are tools that we can utilize with our clients too. You know, some may resonate more deeply for them than others, but there are so many ways of talking about resistance and talking about negative thoughts and talking about fear, and different texts and tools that we can use. So it's just kind of,
I love it. Yeah.
Inspiring.
Yes, I can feel it. And I can feel like that excitement, and it feels like connections for yourself and connections as a practitioner. I'm so glad you mentioned both of those books as well. Great. Good. Anybody else want to share what's coming up? What's feeling important? What are you seeing? What's striking you? Julie?
I don't know if I have a fully formed thought here. I kept trying to type it, and I was like, I couldn't focus on the thought and what you're saying at the same time. Just like, I feel like what you're describing about the negative thought patterns, when left unchecked, form what we recognize as our own or another person's disposition. So I'm thinking of my husband, for example, who I jokingly refer to as a grumpy bear. He can just be a total hothead, you know, and quick to be negative or cynical. And I can recognize, and sometimes we can talk about ways that it's like, okay, well, what's really going on beneath the surface? What's really happening beneath the way you're reacting to this person or this situation. So I guess that's as far as I have gone with the forming of that thought, but I think you get the gist. And the other thing I just wanted to share regarding the Eckhart Tolle book, there's a really excellent 10-part podcast series with Eckhart and Oprah on her Super Soul Conversations, where they thoroughly go through each chapter of the book, and they have callers call in with questions, and then he's able to like elaborate on the ideas with live examples, and it's really good stuff.
That's great. I'm going to check that out. Thanks for sharing that. And you know, the first piece that you were talking about with your husband, really loved what you said. And what I want to point out for you and for all of us is just even the asking of that question, okay, what's underneath this, right? And as coaches and practitioners, we're asking lots of, you know, whatever the question is, but just the asking of the question supports slowing down. Which again, because these thoughts are firing so quickly all the time, that's when they're not caught, and then we can't work with them. But when we start to investigate and explore and ask questions, it creates insights, it creates new ideas, it creates ahas, breakthroughs, yes to all that, but it also supports in just starting to slow things down a little bit so that we or our clients can start to see things as they are and understand a little bit more this distinction between truth and story. Good. All right. We still have a lot to take a look at today. So I'll take Lisa and Deva, and then we're going to keep on going. Lisa.
Mine's quite quick. I've had a lot of catastrophic thinking. We've been moving house and that is really tiring. It's like, I was thinking every single sort of action, what's the worst thing that could go wrong? And how can I circumvent that? And I don't usually think like that every day, all the time. So yeah, I found it really, the catastrophic thinking for me is really tiring.
It is. It is. I mean, as a fellow catastrophic thinker, I hear you on that. It can be tiring. It can be anxiety making. It can be depressing, all of it. And so it's so interesting what you shared about, you know, you ask like, what's the worst thing that can happen and how can I mitigate that? And that might be for you, Lisa, an interesting clue about why your catastrophic thinking is coming up for you. And is there possibly a better way for you to preemptively know some solutions or take some actions that doesn't have to involve getting stuck and stewing in catastrophic thinking? That makes sense what I'm saying?
It makes perfect sense, because what I also noticed is like when I'm in the action and the doing of the packing of the boxes, I'm fine. But thinking, it's the thinking that's the tiring bit, not the moving house. That wasn't tiring at all. It was the thinking about moving house that was tiring. And it's so yeah, definitely catch it quicker. But like,
and be like, oh, I actually already have a solution for this, so I don't need to keep on thinking this thought. I'm taking care of it.
yeah. To some extent, I managed that.
good.
To some extent, work in progress.
Yes, always.
Oh, thanks.
Deva.
Oh, I'm just really enjoying all of this. And I also was listening to some work with Eckhart Tolle and during the week of teaching the sound healing at Esalen and going over the throat chakra, of how the frequencies are like entities. And a lot of times dominant culture, it's, you know, like we can get a song stuck in our head, but we can also get these frequencies that we adopted, you know, before we were seven, of, you know, I'm not worthy, or I'm in trouble. I had a big aha with a friend. We were talking about being raised Catholic and how we had to go to confession. And she was like, what could a little girl who's like 6 or 7 have possibly done wrong? And we were talking about how she would make up something that was felt big enough to need to go to confession. And I was like, I know I had to go to confession. And it was like, I thought badly about my sister. And I was constantly thinking, what have I done to be in trouble that I need to confess? And there was just this big aha of how I remember this time in my life of being like, I just feel like I'm constantly in trouble. I've constantly done something wrong. And how these, you know, these frequencies are these entities from, if it's dominant culture or religion, they get so deeply imbued. And with the subconscious mind, we don't want to have to relearn how to tie our shoes and brush our teeth all the time, but also these things, these thought forms really get stuck in a vibrational matrix in the body. And so, like, using sound is a really powerful way, recognizing that there's audible sound, but the inaudible sound of thought forms really need to be investigated. So I always say, be a soul scientist, like, you know, like you're talking about, Joanna, of just having the awareness that we can slow down and unravel, like, where they come from, because so often they're just so, so old and untrue, but they're so deeply rooted. So
yeah, thank you for sharing all that. First, I love this. What you're sharing is kind of sparking for me. You're sharing, like, songs get stuck in our head. It's like, what is the song that I want, you know, stuck in my head, and choosing that. We'll talk more about that in some ways. And then also this piece that you're speaking to, it reminds me a little bit of Angie's share too, in the sense that so many of these thoughts, just like our fears, we looked at this with our fears, they come from the then and there. They don't come from the here and now, but we're just projecting them onto the here and now because we haven't separated out. And sometimes thoughts from the then and there, to your point, Deva, sometimes thoughts from the then and there get formed because of experiences that we have. Other times thoughts get formed because they're so deeply ingrained in the culture that we haven't interrogated, like I was saying earlier, we haven't interrogated them. I'm so glad you're bringing this up, because part of our work, I believe, as practitioners, is to support our clients to interrogate the internalized messages, usually from patriarchy, but wherever, right? To interrogate the internalized messages that we've just taken as truth our whole lives and operated with them as truth, and to deconstruct those. Beautiful. Julie, I'm not going to take your hand raised now because we still have a lot to take a look at today. But I'll hang out at the end for a little bit. Okay, a couple of other foundational kind of things to think about when it comes to thoughts. Oftentimes we can't change the circumstances in our lives, but we can change how we think about or perceive the circumstances in our lives. This is where thoughts become really important too. So I haven't read A Course in Miracles, but I've, like, read a lot about A Course in Miracles. I love Marianne Williamson, who writes a lot about it. And in The Course in Miracles, which is a book or a set of books, it says that a miracle is a shift in perception. Some of you have probably heard this before. A miracle is a shift in perception. In other words, a miracle is a shift in how we think. So a miracle isn't necessarily when our outside circumstances change. It's when our internal responses to our circumstances change. When, now this isn't true in all situations, of course, but in many situations, when you can change your thoughts about something, you can feel better. You can be in a better mood. You can have a better outlook. You can have less anxiety, and you can maybe even then find some solutions to take next. Our circumstances aren't always in our control. I know some coaches say like every single one of your circumstances is in your control, but I think that comes from a place of privilege, and that's not true all the time. Sometimes they're not, right? Like that's just a fact of life. Like my mother has multiple sclerosis and she's really, really sick. And that is like a circumstance of my life. I cannot change that. So our circumstances aren't always in our control, but how we experience those circumstances, the narrative we choose to create or see in those circumstances, and who we are and how we feel as a result of those circumstances are often in our control. I want to just pause on this because to me, this is such a powerful and profound idea. Can you think of a time when you've had a shift of perception and it's been miraculous? It's changed everything for you, even when the outside situation wasn't changing in that moment. Okay. All right. Let's talk about the brain itself for a moment. Because understanding how the brain itself works is also can be really important when it comes to rewiring negative thought patterns. What I'm about to share, and I've said before, I'm not great at explaining science, so I'm going to like explain it at a second grade level. And probably most of you know this, but it's important to come back and remember it. Neuroscientists have found that our thoughts actually physically shape our brains. So what that means is that when you think something, when you have a thought, for example, I can't do it, or I'm not good at this, or I'm great at this, whatever the thought is, your brain literally creates a physical groove or a fast track inside of it with that particular thought. So that's called a neural pathway, and a neural pathway is created every time you have a thought. And the more you think that thought, the deeper the groove or the pathway, that's how it changes the brain, right? It grooves deeper and deeper every time you have that thought. Here's the other thing neuroscientists have found, that our brains are kind of lazy. So what that means is that when there's an idea that has been thought a couple of times and it's created a deeper groove in the brain doesn't actually want to go to the trouble to try to think a contrary thought. It's just easier to keep on thinking that same thought. It's like, if any of you are skiers skiing down a mountain where someone else has already skied and there's a groove, is like easier than creating new grooves in the snow. So when I say rewiring, I literally mean rewiring the neural pathways in the brain. Does that rudimentary explanation kind of make sense? Yeah. Okay, good. So if we're literally talking about rewiring the brain, oh, Fenton uses the snow too, yay. Then it, I think it's valuable for a moment for us all to acknowledge how incredibly powerful our brains and our minds are. And a way of really understanding how powerful our minds are is to think about the placebo effect. I could literally give you so many examples of so many studies, but I'm just going to give a couple to illustrate how powerful our mind is. I have three examples. The first two, I've been teaching this particular class for like 15 years. So the first two are very old examples from, people always ask where do the studies come from? I can't tell you the first two, but if you want to look up the third one, that's like newer that I've added in, I can tell you. Okay, so this is from a study of pain patients and placebos. In 9 double-blind studies comparing placebos to aspirin, placebos proved to be 54% as effective as the actual medication. So sugar pills, 54% as effective. Now, from this, you might think that placebos are maybe less effective when compared to a much stronger painkiller like morphine, but actually the opposite is true. In 6 studies, placebos were found to be 56% as effective as morphine in relieving pain. In other words, 56% of people that were in intense pain were told they were given something for the pain, even though they were given nothing for the pain, and they felt better from it. Here's another example. In a study of a kind of chemotherapy, 30% of the individuals in the control group, the ones given the placebos, lost their hair. 30%. They were not given chemo, but thought they were given chemo, they lost their hair. Think about the power of the mind. I'll give you one more. In another study, the research team told participants that sniffing a special odor would boost their creativity, but it was just like a scent. It was just an odor. After sniffing the scent, most of the participants demonstrated greater creativity. Okay, you all know this, but it's important to say placebos aren't a replacement for validated medical interventions. Just important to say that. But I give these examples because at least to me, they're so powerful when it comes to, if we can shift our thoughts about things, we can shift our actions about things. All right, let me pause there. Anything that wants to be shared about neural pathways, grooving, power of the brain? Yeah, Wendy.
This is so much fun. So my husband and I started this a couple weeks ago. We listened to, I think it was a Mel Robbins podcast, and it was talking about this very thing and how our brains have a tendency to go toward the negative, right? And really focus on that, kind of like the, you know, ski tracks. And so to help rewire, she's talking about celebrating all the things, right? High five all the successes. And it really, really resonated with my husband. And I'm so grateful for that because he has really kind of continued this activity that we've brought into our home now, and it's finally starting to pick up for me that I'm like, oh wait, this is actually working. I'm talking about like, we did the dishes. Hell yeah. High five. I picked up the puppy's toys. I'll go upstairs to his office. High five. Picked up the dog's toys. Like, we are celebrating all the things. And I'm actually starting to kind of like physically have a change of, I'm smiling more. I actually noticed this morning. I was like, oh shit, I'm actually smiling more. Just, and not necessarily for any reason, just, but it's just, this is so fascinating to me. And I love this so much. And I love this new practice that we've picked up. So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I'm so excited. And I love your example also, because it's also great evidence of what I was saying at the beginning of the call about the difference between a breakthrough and a transformation. It's related to what we're talking about with the ski tracks and the neural pathways here, right? Like, thinking a thought once is maybe a new thought once is the breakthrough, right? That's great. I can do this. Or this is, there are things to be celebrated in life. Things are going well, but that's not what's going to have you randomly start smiling more throughout the day or the week. It's the coming back. I'm going to celebrate that. And I'm going to celebrate that. And I'm going to celebrate that. And then that's the persistence and consistency that moves the original breakthrough. Like, oh, there might be things in my life to celebrate, to the feeling different and the seeing things differently without so much effort involved. Beautiful. Thank you for that. I love that. And I love that you're doing it together with your husband. It's good to have a partner to do the work. Okay. So far, everything we've looked at, and you know, this is how we always do it, is first I give you kind of like the foundational principles so that you can understand the backdrop. And now we're going to start looking at the rewiring process, or my rewiring process. We'll probably just get to the first step today, and then we'll get to the rest in our next class. The process has 5 steps. It is not dissimilar to the befriend your fear process, but it's got some nuances and different entry points into it. So just, you have more in your toolbox. I have to teach it in a linear fashion because that's the only way you can teach, but you don't have to necessarily do these, all of the steps in order, right? Like, as you know, when you're actually with clients, it can be cyclical. 2 things can come together. You're always going to coach the what based on the who. What I want to say going into this also, this is important, is that rewiring isn't simply coming up with a statement and then repeating it over and over again. That just like, I will be rich, I will be rich, I will be rich. It doesn't, I know a lot of people out there say like that's, but that actually doesn't work. For many reasons. And, you know, sometimes people will call that a mantra. That's actually not really what a mantra is. And the reason why Hindu mantras have been scientifically proven to be effective has to do with the fact that when you say them, they're said in tunes and rhythms and singing, and it's less about the words and more about, as Deva was saying earlier, the vibration and how it affects the body, and then how that impact on the body affects the mind. So when we're talking about rewiring here, we're not talking about, you know, just like repeating the same thing over and over again, as we already know, in order to create change, also, we want to hit more than one level of learning and processing. So even though this is about rewiring neural pathways, we want to activate other levels, somatic levels or heart levels or spirit levels. Make sense? Okay. So first step, and usually this one is linear, like usually this is one that you're going to want to do first, identify the negative thought. So as we looked at earlier, oftentimes our thoughts happen so quickly or so persistently that we don't even notice that we've had an unhelpful thought. We just think it's the truth or the way that things need to be or will always be, etc. And so that's why it's so important, first and foremost, to become aware when a negative thought comes up and identify it. This is where all of our listening skills are so vital, right? Because for our client, most likely, again, it's happening so fast for them that they're not even noticing, they're not seeing the difference, as we've been talking about, between the truth and the story. We want to listen for that. When we can identify, then we can begin to see the difference between the truth and the story. David Burns is an author and a psychiatrist. He has a book called The Feeling Good Handbook, also kind of dated now, but still, well, it's old, but not dated. It's still very relevant. Anyway, in this book, David Burns talks about what he calls common cognitive distortions. And I want to share some of the ones that he mentions, because it's good for us as practitioners. It helps us kind of listen for and identify some of those negative thoughts, because they can be a little sneaky sometimes. Like, we want to be able to detect them. Okay, so here's some common cognitive distortions. Number one, all or nothing thinking. In other words, all or nothing thinking is evaluating people or situations in extreme black or white terms. For example, since I didn't get this job, I'll never get a job that makes me happy. All or nothing thinking. We're going to go way deeper into this when we get to myth of perfection, but it's relevant here as well. David Burns talks about mental filtering. So what that is letting a single negative experience negatively color the whole situation. Letting a single negative experience negatively color the whole situation. So for example, you're preparing lunch for some friends who are coming over, and then you realize that you forgot to buy the essential ingredient for the lunch, like right before they arrive. So mental filtering is you then forget about the great time that's going to be had, the connection among friends, how the side dishes will be good. And you just let that one thing ruin the whole situation. Here's another one. He calls disqualifying the positive. You know, and each of these are related, by the way. So disqualifying the positive is taking a neutral or even a positive experience and turning it into a negative one. I'm very good at this, just FYI. So for example, a friend comes over to visit and tells you that you look great. And your immediate thought is, I don't feel great. She doesn't understand. Or she's probably saying that because I usually don't look great. It just happened to look good today, right? So you're taking something positive and you're making it negative. Jumping to conclusions, another one he talks about. So jumping to conclusions is quickly jumping to a negative conclusion that isn't justified by the facts of the situation. And he talks about two different ways of jumping to conclusions. So one he calls mind reading. This is when you assume you know why somebody else does what they do and you don't bother to check it out. So for example, you pass a coworker in the hallway and you say hi, and the coworker doesn't respond. You mind read and automatically assume that that person is upset with you or hates your guts, that you did something wrong. But maybe when you check it out, you find that that coworker was preoccupied about a sick child at home or something that just happened with the boss, and that's why they didn't say hello. That's mind reading. Another way of jumping to conclusions is fortune telling. So in other words, it's when you just quote unquote know that things are going to turn out badly. For example, you wake up with a headache and then you decide that your whole day is ruined. You're fortune telling. Or I have so much to do, so I'm not going to be able to get it done. Fortune telling. I'll share a couple more. Emotional reasoning. That's when you take your emotions as evidence for the truth. Now, this is a toughie because, especially for those of us that believe in trusting our intuition, right? It's distinguishing between that inner wisdom or intuition versus our emotions. So it's when you take your emotions as evidence for the truth. If you feel that something is right, then it must be true. I feel useless, therefore I am useless. It's emotional reasoning, right? Different than tapping into your inner wisdom or intuition. Two more, labeling. That's when you identify a mistake or a negative quality and then describe an entire situation in terms of that quality. So for example, instead of seeing yourself as an individual who's working through difficulties and balancing everything in your life, you might just find yourself saying, I'm defective, I can't get it together, right? Labeling. And then the last one I'll share for today, personalization, what David Burns calls personalization, taking responsibility for a negative event when the circumstance is just beyond your control. So for example, maybe you and your partner are going out to eat at a restaurant and the food isn't so good. And then you find yourself feeling responsible for making a bad choice of the restaurant and ruining the weekend and deciding that you suck. All right, which ones are hitting you? Which ones? I mean, I feel like I have and do all of them, but are there any in particular that are standing out and you're like, oh, I do that a lot? By the way, these are all forms of catastrophic thinking in one way or another too. Dottie.
Thank you, Joanna. Emotional reasoning is one that I use quite often. And I really like how you said it's different than tapping into inner wisdom or intuition. I'm curious if you could offer any suggestions as how to maybe see a client doing that, or maybe even identifying for yourself.
Yeah. So let me think how to articulate this. I think with the emotional reasoning, where I see it the most is when people say negative things about themselves that are just based on how they're feeling about a certain situation. So I suck, I'm useless. It's similar to the labeling for me, like how I've seen the emotional reasoning is like when they're deciding something about themselves based on a discomfort about a certain situation not working out or something bad happening. So it's like they feel it, like I feel so useless, or I feel like I suck, or I feel like I'm a fool. And then they're deciding that that's what it is. Okay. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Lisa. Oh, can't hear you.
It's the fortune telling. So if a client doesn't give feedback, and it could be any kind of feedback, at the end of a session, I immediately assume I've failed. Sometimes this just ebbs and flows. It depends on who the client is, but it's not productive.
Yes, right. It must be, I must have failed, right? It's just, of course. That's a great place. Like now that you've identified that, that's a great place to track throughout the week. When does that come up? Call yourself on it. Be like, oh, I'm fortune telling right now, right? What's the truth here? Oh, they didn't respond to that one thing or whatever it is. And then what's the story?
Right. Yeah, it's related to the mind reading, that example you gave too. Mm-hmm. Somebody didn't say hi, oh, they hate me, but...
Yeah, kind of like a conflation of the two. Good. Okay. All right, we've got a couple of minutes left. Take a minute or two right now and make a list of some of your most common negative or unhelpful thoughts. What are some of your most common, the ones that tend to come up a lot for you? Could be about anything. And if you can share them in the chat, that would be great, just to kind of hear different ones and normalize. What's one of your most common ones? One of mine is everybody hates me. Everybody hates me. I don't manage my time well. I'm not a good business person. I don't appeal to anyone. They probably won't be interested in what I have to say or offer or do. I'm too sensitive. I'm such a pain or an inconvenience. I'm not hardy and I need to be stronger. I'm not ready. Yeah. Good. I will I will never know enough to feel ready. I don't know what I'm doing. So whatever it is for you, I really want to encourage you to track it. Over the week, start to catch yourself when the thought comes up, or you can, at the end of the day, you can look back at the day and say, okay, when did my maybe don't follow five. If you wrote down five thoughts, maybe one or two, when did this come up today? What was the truth of the situation that it came in up in? And what's the story, right? Truth is I sent out a resume, didn't get called for the interview. Story is I suck, I blah, 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 right? All the things. Just as a way to start, we're going to go a lot deeper next time we meet, but as a way to start to become aware and to just see, to shift some of rewired a little bit in those moments. Now, when we are in session with clients, so I just asked you to make a list, you know, because we're in class together, but when we're in session with clients, there's a couple of ways that you're going to be able to identify. So number one, like I said earlier, through your listening skills, right? If you hear someone saying something, they don't realize it. That's going to be one primary way. Another way that you can identify with a client a negative thought is, what's the belief that's holding you back right now? Or what's the story that you're telling yourself right now about this situation? Or what's the thought that's stopping you in your tracks right now, right? Those are just some examples of questions, but we can ask a pointed question to co-create awareness with a client to identify the negative thought. This is step one only, right? We'll get to everything else later. Now, last piece, this is important, related to listening skills and all of that. Check filters and listen carefully and be willing to challenge your client's beliefs. So I'll give you an example of this. From about a year ago, I have a client who is a very successful entrepreneur, and she was pregnant. She was going to have a baby in a couple of months. And she came into a session, always at the beginning of the session, I ask, what do you want to receive? And she said, well, what I really want to look at today and what I really want to receive is how I can optimize bringing in more money before my maternity leave. How I can optimize bringing in more money before my maternity leave. Sounds fine, right? She wanted in her last trimester to work more so that she could have money, because she wasn't going to be making money during her maternity leave. But here's the thing, because I was using my listening skills, and because I always use my listening skills, and, you know, and in previous sessions with her, I knew a lot of things about this client. Number one, that her business was going to continue to make money even when she was on maternity leave. Number two, that she's an overworker, and that really what she wanted most for herself was to have space in this third trimester, not to think of new ideas and new ways to optimize and market and do more. What she really wanted for herself was to have space before this baby came, right? So I challenged her. So on the outset, this didn't sound like a negative thought. I need to optimize my money before my maternity leave. But I knew for this client, back to, is it helpful or unhelpful? I knew that it was an unhelpful thought for her. And I challenged her on that. And through the work that we did together, she actually ended up planning for how she could have as much space as possible during that third trimester and use that as practice for not being so, what's the word? I just lost it. So like hyper responsive to everything in her business that she actually could chill out a little bit. Does that make sense? For another client, optimizing in the third trimester might have been totally helpful for them, but not for this client. Okay. All right. We are exactly at 3:30. If you have like 30 seconds left, I'd love for you to just take a moment and write down what's one of the biggest things that you're taking away from our time together today. And I'd love to hear, please share in the chat. And also, I'd love to hear one of your voices. What are you taking away from your time together today? Who wants to have the last word? I don't want it to be me. What are you taking away? Michelle's saying the common cognitive distortions. Good. Anyone want to share? All right, then I will trust that you are taking away exactly what you need. I will not see you next week, but I'll see you in 2 weeks. Use this time for integration, for catch up on everything we've been looking at the last few weeks, for working persistently and consistently, either on a befriend your fear or on a resistance archetype, or starting to track negative thought patterns. Sending you all lots of love. We'll see you soon. Bye.